Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and across the region this Tuesday, October 24th, 2023. Sudan's political parties try to hash out a way to end the brutal fighting at home during talks in Juba.
RSF is part of the conflict, and it has to be approached such that he's on table. If he's not on the table, then automatically there is no peace.
And Warup State officials say gunmen have killed five people in Twitch County.
The government of Warup State is sending sincere condolences to the three families who were victimized by the attack.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Representatives of 14 Sudanese political parties are meeting in Juba today in a bid to restore peace in their own country. A South Sudanese official says the meeting is aimed at ending the fighting between two Sudanese military generals. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Dilma Thok, Secretary General of the South Sudan Committee that mediated talks, which led to the signing of the Juba Peace Agreement in October 2020, says the two-day consultative meeting was convened by South Sudan President Salva Kiir. Mathoka says South Sudan officials want to hear from the Sudanese political parties what they think can be done to end a bloody conflict that began in mid-April and also find out what they think South Sudan can do to help end the fighting.
The president decided to invite the signatories to peace agreement, Juba peace agreement, to come and see how they should actually join hands, say that what is taking place in Sudan is at least stopped, especially the cessation of hostility.
Mathok says the initiative also aims to support various peace initiatives underway, including the one in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. He says the Juba initiative will try to unite the Sudanese political parties to positively contribute toward resolving the conflict. The paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, which is fighting the Sudanese army, are not taking part. Mathok says the 2 days of meetings bring together only the 14 political parties that signed the Juba Peace Agreement in 2020, but says South Sudan recognizes the importance of including the RSF in any peacemaking efforts.
RSF is part of the conflict, and it has to be approached such that he's on table. If he is not on the table, then automatically there is no peace. So they must have to be part of what is taking place now.
Key members of the Sudan Sovereign Council, such as Deputy Chairperson Malik Agar and Jibril Ibrahim, the Minister of Finance and Economic Planning, are at the meeting. Some Sudanese politicians call the meeting a golden opportunity to resolve the conflict, while others say the initiative should be coordinated with the other regional initiatives to restore peace in Sudan. Sudanese participant Alhadi Idris praised President Kiir's decision to convene the meeting of the Sudanese political parties.
I want to tell the Republic of South Sudan that people have the responsibility of stopping the conflict in Sudan. I am one person who believes that South Sudan is capable of transiting Sudan from this situation and can urge the warring parties to come to peace.
Ismail Ways, the IGAD special envoy in South Sudan who attended the meeting, says any efforts that would yield fruits should focus on first silencing the guns.
What we would like to see, IGAD and the African Union jointly with the support of the international community, is to stop this fight. Let us join hands. This is not a time for long talks and for...
The 14 Sudanese political groups in 2020 resolved to end decades of conflicts in Darfur, South Kordofan, Eastern Sudan, and Southern Blue Nile. According to the UN, nearly 10,000 people have been killed and 4.5 million others have been displaced within Sudan and in neighboring countries. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Authorities in South Sudan's War Upstate say at least five people, including three women, were killed and six others were injured yesterday when armed young men suspected of crossing into the state from the neighboring Abyei Special Administrative Area attacked a military barracks in Twik County. A War Upstate official says the gunmen also killed two South Sudanese soldiers. Dengai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor.
William Wall Mayom, the information minister in Warab State, says a group of men thought to be from the neighboring Abyei Special Administrative Area stormed the military barracks in Ajakwaj Payam of Twik County and killed five people. Three women and two men who were South Sudan People's Defense Force soldiers died. Six other people were injured in Monday's attack.
The attack is on them in stronger time possible. The government of Warab State is sending sincere condolences to the three families who were victimized by the attack. We also ask Abyei Special Administrative Area to dialogue and convince Abyei armed youth to refrain from attacking Warab State.
Bol Koch, the information minister and spokesperson for the Abyei Special Administrative Area, says he is aware of the attack in Warab State, but denies the attackers were from his area.
We don't have youth that have gone and attacked in Warab. The information we have is that the attackers who fought in Bombil are not from Abyei. They might be armed militias because there are several armed militias operating within parts of Abyei, like the militia of Guy Machek and the militia of Stephen Boy. To establish what I'm saying, we have received two injured people, and they are not native people from Abyei.
Koch accused young men from Twik County, Warab State, of colluding with militias to attack and kill 14 people in Abyei about 2 weeks ago.
The armed militia and youth from the same area, Ajakwaj, came and carried out attacks. But now the situation has returned to normalcy because we deployed the local security forces and put in place a curfew from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. We urge our counterparts in Warab State to do more to control their youth from attacking Abyei because there is nothing we can achieve in this fighting. Let us work for peace.
Minister Wall dismissed the accusation, saying youth from Warab did not attack Abyei.
The attack that they accused Warab State took place on the northern part of Abyei. And as said, you know very well, an enemy cannot go to the far north and make any attack. So if they have decided to make a revenge attack because of the recent incident that happened in Abyei, then it is misplaced.
Antoinette Midey is the acting spokesperson for the United Nations Interim Security Force for Abyei, or UNISPA. Midey says UNISPA is working closely with local communities, authorities and international partners to support peace and security efforts in the area.
The mission has been receiving a lot of reports of likely attacks in the box and is working closely with local authorities and the local community to deter any such attacks. Among the things that the mission is doing is the force has changed its posture. And through collaborative efforts, joint air and ground patrols are being carried out across the various sectors within our area of operation.
Earlier this year, UNISPA reiterated the UN Security Council call that Sudan and South Sudan take steps to ensure that the Abyei region is free of any armed groups and other forces. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
As the world marks Disarmament Week, South Sudan continues to struggle to build a safer country by eliminating unnecessary weapons. As James Shimanyula reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, since the United Nations was founded in 1945, the world body has worked to meet its aim of reducing dangers through serious political dialogue and negotiation, not by arms. And that includes in South Sudan.
The UN Office for Disarmament Affairs, which supports implementing practical disarmament measures after a conflict, says the use of heavy weapons in populated areas seriously endangers civilians. South Sudan, the world's newest nation, is one of the countries where heavy weapons have been used for more than 11 years. The country's former defense minister, Angelina Teng, wife of Vice President Riek Machar, confirms that hundreds of thousands of civilians continue to hold illegal weapons.
Weapons Bureau have done a survey and they have found that on average a household in South Sudan have 7 rifles.
Abraham Kuch is the South Sudan Director of Arms Control.
We estimate that there are about 700,000 guns being held illegally by the civil population. Could be more. There is an argument that civilians are even more armed than our national army.
Kuch indicates authorities know where the weapons come from, and it is mostly from members of the South Sudan Defense Forces and the National Police Service.
It's intertwined with the fact that some of our organized forces are not properly taken care of, that their salaries are not there, some of them are really, really suffering.
Kwol Nyon, Dean of the College of Economic and Social Studies at the University of Juba and security expert, supports that thinking.
Security agents are not well enumerated, and as a result of that, they resort using whatever the means that they have, these arms, whether by using them to get some income for their own family.
Every year, World Disarmament Week begins on October 24th, the anniversary of the founding of the United Nations. The UN Office for Disarmament Affairs says in its latest report that measures for disarmament are pursued for maintaining international peace and security, upholding the principles of humanity, protecting civilians, promoting sustainable development, and preventing armed conflicts. For VOA Africa, I'm James Shimanyula in Nairobi, Kenya.
And on this 78th United Nations Day, UN agencies and civil society activists are using the occasion to call for what they describe as genuine institutional reforms in South Sudan. Marie-Helene Verny, the UN World Food Program's country director for South Sudan, says there is a need to build strong institutions that will bring about sustainable peace and development in the country. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this report from Juba.
Nicholas Haysom, special representative of the United Nations Secretary General in South Sudan, says the country is in a difficult situation, confronting many problems, including intercommunal violence.
South Sudan faces a humanitarian and economic emergency of an unprecedented nature. Against a backdrop of an unsettled regional neighborhood beset by conflict and its own political and ethnic fault lines at home, competing global priorities are making it difficult to prioritize international assistance for South Sudan. This combination of factors presents a high mountain to climb for South Sudan, if it is to deliver on its commitments.
Haysom says he thinks South Sudan can overcome the challenges it faces and ensure its people enjoy the dividends of peace. Speaking at an event in Juba on Tuesday to mark the United Nations Day, Haysom said the country needs strong institutions to restore the hopes and aspirations of its people.
We believe the challenges ahead can bring out the best in the South Sudanese, if a sense of common destiny and shared future compels the imperative to work together. These are the true values of the UN Charter.
According to the UN, last year South Sudan ranked last in implementing the Sustainable Development Goals. It says 8 million out of 12 million people in South Sudan live in extreme poverty, while 7.5 million people are food insecure. In addition, maternal mortality rate remains high. Marie-Helene Feni, the World Food Programme country representative in South Sudan, says the UN will refocus its work to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals by 2030.
It's food systems, it's jobs and social protection, it's education and health. So a general sense that unless there is progress in all these areas at the same time, and they also include digital connectivity and climate change, unless we have progress in all these areas together, focusing on one and not the other is not going to be the solution.
Stephen Parkwall, South Sudan's Minister for Peace Building, says the country is torn apart by intercommunal violence, in part because of the proliferation of arms and weak institutions to deliver security for the communities.
The intercommunal violence that you see in the country here is alarming, and the root cause of it is the collapse of the government institutions.
Lona Merekaje, a civil society activist, says South Sudan's ability to control its stock of arms and ammunition remains questionable, and civilians easily can get hold of weapons.
And our fear as civil society is that if we keep importing more, it might be worse than today. And our appeal is, okay, if you have justifiable reason, then the benchmarks are public information. Are there efforts towards implementing the benchmarks before we ask about lifting of the arms embargo?
Towards sustainable peace and development in South Sudan, what needs to change? Merekaje says, though the UN has contributed a lot in South Sudan, it should shift its focus to sharing its expertise with South Sudanese who will be able to take up roles now held by expatriates. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, a militant group linked to the Islamic State is accused of carrying out more brutal killings in eastern DRC. Stay tuned. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Local authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo are blaming the killings of at least 26 civilians on militants linked to the Islamic State group. The attack took place last night on the outskirts of Oicha, a town in Beni territory. Reporter Jafar Sapidi in North Kivu province tells me that the mayor of Oicha accused the ISIS or IS-affiliated Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, of carrying out the attack on men, women, and children.
ADF, the Islamist Ugandan militia, is pointed to attack because this is a region in eastern Congo, the region of Beni, and they didn't claim yet, but we know that the Islamic State is operating in that region since a long time, and the operating mode is the same. So locals of Beni, and especially those of Oicha, and even their leaders, I know that the attack was made by Islamic State, killing 26 people now, and more people are still missing. Some of people were injured too.
Why is the ADF or the Allied Democratic Forces attacking civilians like this?
We still don't have the real motivation of ADF, but at this moment it may be because of the attack. You know, in that region there is a joint operation between FRDC, the Congolese Army, and the Ugandan Army, UPDF, doing a joint operation against ADF, and this operation has already killed a lot of ADF leaders. Maybe that's the reason pushing ADF to kill more people. But this killing, they are first time, because they usually kill in different villages and cities in that zone. Their motivation still unknown, but one more thing we know is the ADF is affiliated to the Islamic State. As a terrorist group, they can kill without any motivation.
Yeah, it seems indiscriminate. The mayor there, Nicholas Kikuku, is quoted as saying, of those killed, 12 of them were minors.
Yes, that zone has minerals. The zone, Eastern Congo, is rich in minerals and wood. ADF are in the zone since long time, dealing woods, minerals, cocoa, but they could stay with people without killing them. As they are killing people, I think that there is another motivation. It's not only minerals or only making money, but as they are affiliated to the Islamic State, it seems that they are trying to make Khalifa in the central of Africa.
The territory civil society representative said that tensions are high in the town, with protesters setting fire to humanitarian vehicles. These vehicles were about to distribute food. Why would they do that?
You know, locals of Beni territory always angry against authorities and against UN system, because MONUSCO is in the zone now. It's like 20 years ago. that there is no solution, there is no peace and tranquility in the zone. So for them, MONUSCO and all the UN system are doing anything. They have to leave.
Tell us more about the ADF. Have they been a presence in the DRC for a while now?
ADF is a Ugandan militia. When starting, it was not an Islamic militia. It was not like a terrorist group. There was a Museveni opponent who came to stay in Congo, in the forest of eastern Congo, ADF and NALU. But many times after, they became an Islamic radical and extremist movement, claiming their affiliation to the Islamic State and starting killing people.
That is reporter Jafar Sapidi. He was speaking with me earlier today from Goma in North Kivu province of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Senior European Union officials announced last week that the EU would allocate some 150 billion euros or 158.7 billion US dollars over the next 4 years to develop infrastructure across Africa. The EU said its projects would improve Africa's digital economy, boost small and medium enterprises, and revamp energy infrastructure on the continent, as we hear from Darren Taylor.
International economists consider the EU's Global Gateway program to be Europe's answer to China's Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI. Over the past decade, Beijing's invested billions of dollars in infrastructure projects in Africa. News of the EU package came at about the same time as China's president, Xi Jinping, announced $100 billion in new BRI funding to Africa. He said it would be used for high-quality development to achieve modernization for all countries. Late last year, when announcing a new United States strategy in Africa, following the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit held in Washington in December, President Joe Biden said part of the plan was aimed at improving infrastructure in Africa. Economist at the Pretoria-based Frontline Group, Jason Musyoka, says the EU's firing the latest shot in a new scramble for Africa.
The Global Gateway Initiative focuses by and large on three broad aspects, which is the digital transition, energy transition, and transport. The Chinese Belt and Road Initiative has been focusing on traditional infrastructure projects, ports and roads and so on. And so you can clearly see the competition going on here between these two massive initiatives for Africa.
Musyoka is one of the many analysts who say the competition in Africa between the globe's great powers is largely about access to the continent's rare earth minerals. These minerals, such as cobalt, have become indispensable to modern items, from computers to cell phones to electric vehicle batteries. Some of the minerals are also used in weapons systems. Musyoka says the EU's program is an excellent response to China's BRI, which he told VOA has had mixed results in Africa.
There have been cases of what is being referred to as debt trap diplomacy. If countries fail to pay for the infrastructure funding, then their assets are going to be taken by China. So that has been part of the narrative. But 46 countries out of the 54 have signed up. And I think that that is quite significant. I mean, in Tanzania, they have made massive constructions there, for example, Ethiopia as well, and several other countries, particularly within East Africa.
Dr. Kande Yumkela, an economist and politician in Sierra Leone, says the latest EU funding shows Africa's at the center of global geopolitical battles. Speaking during a recent EU International Partnerships webinar, the former United Nations official said the EU program could help Africa achieve the UN's Sustainable Development Goals.
All of those goals are relevant to us: health, education, clean water, energy access, and more importantly, our own ambition to industrialize, to have structural change. In this context, our relationship with Europe has to change from one of donor recipient, from one of a source of raw materials to one of real partnerships with mutual interests that are achieved, particularly the African interest to restructure their economies. We want to be industrialized.
The EU said it's already committed financing to bolster energy production in Africa, including the establishment of mini grids and small hydropower plants in Nigeria, for example. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Concerns of a wider war in the Middle East are growing as the United States is dispatching more military assets and warning of significant threats to Americans and U.S. facilities in the region. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
Israel's military has increased its airstrikes on Gaza, destroying entire neighborhoods amid expectations of an Israeli ground offensive. Amid fears of a wider war erupting, White House National Security Council Coordinator John Kirby said attacks on U.S. interests in the region have increased.
We know Iran continues to support Hamas and Hezbollah. And we know that Iran is closely monitoring these events and in some cases actively facilitating these attacks and spurring on others who may want to exploit the conflict for their own good or for that of Iran. We know Iran's goal is to maintain some level of deniability here, but we're not going to allow them to do that. We also are not going to allow any threat to our interest in the region to go unchallenged.
On Sunday, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke to ABC This Week, saying the United States is boosting its military presence in the Middle East.
Well, Jonathan, as you know, recently we've seen rocket and UAV attacks against bases housing our troops in Iraq and Syria. We're concerned about potential escalation. What we're seeing is the prospect of a significant escalation of attacks on our troops and our people throughout the region. And because of that, we're going to do what's necessary to make sure that our troops are in the right, good position. They're protected.
Since the October 7th attack on southern Israel by the Palestinian militant group Hamas, killing more than 1,400 Israelis, Israel's strikes on Gaza have killed at least 5,000 Palestinians. The United Nations and humanitarian groups are calling for a humanitarian pause in the fighting. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller had this to say on Monday.
Any ceasefire would give Hamas the ability to rest, to refit, and to get ready to continue launching terrorist attacks against Israel.
European Union foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said Monday he believed the group's leaders would back a call for a humanitarian pause to allow aid to enter Gaza. Humanitarian aid continued to trickle into the Gaza Strip as 20 more aid trucks entered. But a lack of fuel for deliveries is threatening to halt the operation, with more than 2 million besieged Palestinians awaiting help. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
And that wraps it up for this Tuesday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss the broadcast, head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Asagoro by Emmy J. That's Asagoro, as you just heard, with Emmy J. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Cornelius Tinner, and producer, Kwame Afore, thanks for joining us today. Have a great day and evening, and we'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.